Since 2013, Bombas has donated over 100 million socks, underwear, and T-shirts to those facing homelessness. If we counted those on air, this ad would last over 1,157 days. But if we counted the time it takes to make a donation possible, it would take just a few clicks. Because every time you make a purchase, Bombas donates an item to someone who needs it.
Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hello and welcome to Your Book, the podcast for literary nosy parkers. I'm your book inspector, Daisy Buchanan. My novel, Insatiable, one of Waterstone's best books of 2021, is now available to pre-order in paperback. Coming in February, you can get an exclusive special edition from Waterstone's with extra chapters and sprayed edges. Waterstone's also have exclusive signed copies of my new novel, Careering, which is coming in March, and it's available for your book listeners to pre-order. Now, on to today's guest, the author and publisher Dave Eggers. His first book, A Heartbreaking Work of Staggering Genius, was a Pulitzer Prize nominee. He founded the literary humour title and publishing house McSweeney's, and we're here to celebrate the publication of his 13th novel, The Everi, a suspense-filled satire about capitalism that follows his 2013 bestseller, The Circle. We talked about Moby Dick, whether books wait for us to read them, and why his wife is the funniest writer he knows. Also, just to make you aware, this interview was conducted over the phone, so the sound isn't quite as clear as we'd have liked it to be, but hopefully it's all still audible. Hi there.
Hi.
Over this last, you know, bizarre 18 months where everything has changed, has your reading changed? Are you picking up different books? Are you reading books in different ways? Are you reading more or reading less? Or has it all stayed fairly consistent?
Let me think about that. I don't think it's changed much. I think for the first 6 months, I was just trying to avoid everybody that was telling me to read The Plague. I just had to keep saying, no, thank you. Or I just did, thanks. The book recommendations early on were really dire. Everybody wanted you to read something about a similar or worse time. It was really strange, but I don't know. Maybe that brought comfort to some people to know that people made it through worse times. But I don't think I altered my reading all that much. But for a while, instead of, I tend to read in the morning when I get up, and instead of reading, I was checking, you know, COVID stats when the pandemic had hit Europe first, and then we were just on the verge and wondering what our case numbers were going to be. I would check that maybe for the first 3-4 hours of the day. And so my reading kind of fell away for 3-4 months. But then I think when things hit a certain level of not predictability, but at least we were deep into the pandemic, I was able to sort of restore my prior reading regimen, I guess.
I think I've heard a lot of people saying that, you know, we think we can control things more by knowing as much as possible. Certainly the people I've spoken to found that they noticed, you know, feeling, I mean, obviously it's not a fair test because of course no one is relaxed. There's a pandemic, but not having as much reading time, it felt stressful. And then when the reading returned, there was a level of, I think, engagement and a level of peace that came with it. Is that something that you felt at all?
I think it's the same level of peace that I get from reading it, especially in the morning. I'd say maybe 10 years ago, I changed my habits from reading more at night to starting the morning with coffee and about, you know, an hour and a half or so of reading, and usually something that I'd been, that I should have read decades ago. So mostly dead people. I would read in the morning.
So that's about as restful as it gets, a dead author. Can you remember the
stuff
you were picking up 10 years ago? Was there anything in particular that triggered the change in routine?
No, I found that I was a lot less likely to fall asleep when I was reading in the morning. And as I was reaching some level of consciousness and with the coffee kicking in, between that and reading some long dead author, it gave me a very calm and sort of, to use a California word, centered sort of feeling at the beginning of the day. And also, you know, ideally you would draw inspiration from whatever you're reading and get excited about going into my garage and starting my own work day. So it's been something that I've been recommending to everybody I know, especially everyone I know that falls asleep within half an hour when they're in bed reading at night. I sort of say, this is a much better way to start the day than checking your email, which is just almost uniformly alarming. This is like a way to sort of ease into the day by sort of walking through these corridors of the past, I guess. And it's like walking through an ancient, you know, campus with, you know, with ivy covered walls and long colonnades. You know, it's just very sort of soothing.
I agree wholeheartedly. In that time, were there any books that you remember thinking, why have I only just got to this now? I wish I'd read this years ago. This is wonderful.
Well, I mean, always. I think invariably half of what I read fits that bill. I just got through an old edition, a modern library edition of the Selected Writings of Herman Melville. And a lot of this is not really available right now. This edition, I think, is from 1954. And there are all these short stories that I think should be canonical, but are very rarely read now. And much, you know, nobody really talks about his short stories outside of Bartleby. And, but there's so much good stuff and so many sort of brief classic stories that you think would be assigned, you know, at the high school and collegiate level, things that you just would have assumed were part of our collective canon. But so I think, you know, you cannot go wrong with Melville. Everything that he writes feels like it was written yesterday just because of the passion and the wit. And he's just so ecstatic about anything, even if he's writing about, you know, an insect that burrowed into a dining room table, which he went on about for, I think, about 18 pages in one of these stories. But still, it leaps off the page.
That's the work of a master, isn't it? Someone who can hold you and take you with them when they're working in that sort of infinitesimal detail. And I think Bartleby shows up in contemporary novels all the time, you know, those ideas and that theme, and it just keeps being revisited, and it's never felt fresher, even though it was, you know, sort of so on point at the time. And sometimes I think I've tried to read Moby Dick and I've never finished it, and I've always felt a bit daunted by it, and maybe I was too young.
Oh, you have to buy really again. That's the best American novel. And I think you know how it's not really the right book for the right person. It's the right time.
Yeah.
And so you might take another run at it and you just never know when it's going to hit, because I tried it a few times in my 20s and 30s and it didn't take. And then in my 40s, I started reading it every couple of years, and it's just, it is very funny, especially the first few chapters. And after that, it's just there's no sort of more, I guess, unique American voice. And given when he wrote, when there was so little, I think, electric American prose, his was the first, I think, truly sort of like lyrical and electricity-ridden sentences that just could not possibly, any one sentence of his could not possibly have been written by anybody else. But that's when he's grappling with the larger themes, and it works on sort of biblical level almost. Mm-hmm. It has that scale of myth and Greek epics, and I think it holds up almost more than any other classic of that era, which, you know, some even a lot of Twain, and certainly a lot of the books from the 20th century just are, you know, they have elements that are kind of dated, and but something about Moby Dick is completely timeless.
Well, I'm definitely going to try again. I know it's, you know, me and a lack of maturity that's stopping me, but I'm 36 and I find it very, very comforting that it took you a few goes to get into it. I wanted to know the first book that you remember reading where you think, this is what books are for, this is my book, the first book that made you feel sort of electrified as an independent reader.
There's two answers to that. One was, I was not a huge reader when I was a kid. I was always outside and wanting to be doing anything but sitting. And so I was just one of those antsy outdoor kids, I guess, that I really did not sit voluntarily and read a novel until my freshman year in high school. I read everything that was assigned to me in class, and I did fine at school and everything. But in terms of like picking up a novel off the shelf and reading it through, that was when I was 14. And that was Dune by Frank Herbert. And I think I just picked it. We had a reading period in high school, freshman year in high school. And we were just put in a room and full of books and pillows, and you had to sit and read for a period, and you had no other choice. And so it took that kind of calm atmosphere and sort of reading mandate to get me, and you could read anything you wanted to in the room. And so I read Dune just based on the cover, I think. And that was the first time I just felt completely transformed or transported and fully immersed in a world that I had chosen. There were other books before that I liked a lot, but they had all been assigned, you know? Like I remember The Book of the Dun Cow being another book like that I felt completely sort of immersed in a few years before.
But like, I didn't get that book.
Oh, The Book of the Dun Cow? God, I gotta look that up. It used to be assigned a lot here. People of my generation often would have been required to read it, and it took place in a farmyard. It was mostly Walter Wangerin. It was sort of a classic of its time. I think it was really, you know, pretty well known book back then, and you know, I think its prominence has diminished a little bit over time, but it's really vivid. It takes place in a farmyard with basically, you know, who's going to rule the roost, you know, in among the roosters in a but it rises to sort of this, you know, incredibly heightened level, even though it's just chickens. So in that way, it was around the same time, I guess, as trying to think of the book about rabbits.
Was it Watership Down?
Yeah, Watership Down. So it's similar in scale and intensity to that, and that it could be read by kids, it could be read, it's sort of an all ages type of book that at least has a accessibility to younger readers because of the, you know, the protagonist being animals. But I think that it's that these are rare things that are sort of rarer now, which is a truly all ages novel, which I think is a very necessary form that we don't talk about or allow so much anymore.
Because I think that's so motivating to younger readers as well. I think reader ever wants to feel sort of talked down to or condescended to, and that, you know, to read in a way that feels really inclusive, I think, you know, that's so unusual and so important.
Do you have, I don't know if UK editions of books for younger readers have age group levels on the back. Do they do that there, where they say this is for ages 5 to 8 and 7 to 9 and things like that?
I remember it when I was a kid. I don't know if there's that on sort of, I guess we call it, I think we know it as middle grade fiction, and sort of for the under 12s. But then sometimes, you know, if I pick up a like a YA book, I've been really surprised and startled by how dark those books and those stories can be. And then I forget, when I was a teenager, that was what I loved and that was all I wanted to read.
Yeah, no, I have two teenagers. So I, the subject matter is impossibly dark. I think the book that my son, who's 12, just read was about the ghost of a young boy who had been shot and killed in one of our American cities riddled with gun violence. And so it was told from his point of view, which I just thought was so bleak, but my son loved it. And so I think that there should be, I think, categorizing books as middle grade or elementary level or this age group. We really do it down to a science here, where this is for ages 7 to 9. Or 8.3 to 10.4, or however, you know, it's really diminishing. And I think if you're a reader that doesn't exactly fit into, you know, the exact reading level of your age, it can be shaming. And I think it's just such a destructive thing to have all of, you know, micro categories listed on the back of a book so that you drive away everybody else. It's a terrible thing. It probably had good intentions when they started doing it, but I think it's bad for literature for sure.
Definitely. I mean, you know, thinking of you as a high school freshman, and I imagine if that was applied now, you know, there's no way that Dune would have sort of got into your hands under a teacher's direction anyway. I could be completely wrong about this, but I believe that when, you know, we worry about younger people and what they're exposed to, and I think on a page is sometimes the best way to be exposed to it, you know.
Yeah, it's a very safe place. It's everything that I think would be much more startling in a different medium is more, the word digestible isn't the right word, but it's close enough. You can handle, I think, much more tough information and situations on the page. And I always say that, you know, having, we have a center here called 826 Valencia that we started back in 2002, and it's a writing center for young people ages 8 to 18. And I think for them as writers, it's a safe place where everything chaotic and uncontrollable in their lives, they can put it on the page and it becomes tamer and is given a boundary and is given a beginning, a middle, and an end, and a certain peace can come over a kid that feels their life is not within their control, and suddenly they are controlling their narrative again. And so for as readers and writers, you find kids that read a lot are tend to be calmer, you know, more sort of thoughtful about their world, more empathetic. But that calmness is really something that I've seen for 20 years now, that it's very different than the jittery way that kids that live mostly through screens appear. You know, if I could only convince everybody of the and I remember feeling it, you know, reading Dune, just being forced to sit still and being forced to, you know, be partner to the creation of that world, because when you're reading as a kid, you are an equal partner with the author in terms of bringing that to life, because it's your imagination that's coloring, you know, the skeletal.
It's such a great way to put it. And, you know, I think every book that gets read, it becomes a different book every time for that reason. You know, there are sort of potentially infinite worlds and books and ways of reading and ways of, you know, having your imagination be prompted. I was curious about whether there are, other than anything you've mentioned, any books that you've shared with your children, any books that your children have shared with you, and anything that you hope that they're going to come to in time.
Well, sure. I mean, at this point, it's been hundreds of books. This is a, you know, by this age, you've read probably 500 picture books, right? By the time they're this age, and then another few hundred chapter books. And so it's really hard to pinpoint. And now we're just at that, you know, that last stage where you're not reading together as much. What's funny is that we always made these attempts. I mean, speaking of some books that don't necessarily age as well, I remember looking at we bought an edition of all of the Wizard of Oz books that had been reissued, and really sort of a reproduction of the original books with the same illustrations. And we went at that thinking that we would be revisiting these classics and that they would, you know, be just as we imagined, because I don't know if I ever read the Wizard of Oz books as a kid. You just see the movie and that's that. But it was interesting to see that these were almost incomprehensible to us. You know, the language was very stilted and dense and really hard to figure out where the action was and like what actually was going on. And I think that you do find that every so often where our style of language and how we read and sort of how even sentences are structured and chapters and sort of what we expect in terms of clarity of action and has changed a lot. And I think that series was a funny one where as much as we appreciated the craft of the book and beautiful presentation and everything, they just didn't sing the way that you'd expect them to still. And maybe that's a bad answer to that. Maybe I should just be celebrating some books that we did love. I will say that we read a contemporary edition of Dr. Doolittle maybe 4 years ago that I was amazed at how great that was. And I think it's been rewritten in different forms, but between that and things like Treasure Island really holds up, and Mr. Popper's Penguins really holds up. And I'm always interested in those books that transcend time. Essie Hinton's books, Beverly Cleary's books to some extent, where they sort of read exactly as they did when you were a kid. They come alive the exact same way.
I loved those books, and I found them. They're in our local library, and I don't know, are they in like Connecticut or Cleveland? But it just, you know, in the middle of sort of, you know, rural Buckinghamshire, their world sounded so thrilling and exotic, even though, you know, quite normal things are being described. And so the Beast and Ramona universe.
Yeah, I think, you know, it again, if it's done well, you know, if you read Wind in the Willows, that also, The Trumpet of the Swan, trying to think of, you know, you come to these books again, hoping, desperately hoping that they still work, I guess, and that there hasn't been anything lost. And Charlotte's Web is still a perfect book. And but I think every so often, you know, the books have their time and place, and they don't work for us as well as others. And I think that's a very, you know, it's a hard to determine what would or wouldn't. But I do think that when you go back to a certain sort of passion on the page and a sort of that kind of thing, whether it's Othello for me or Melville or Willa Cather, or, you know, I'm trying to think of a lot of the dead people that I go back to again and again. So much of it has to do with just sort of a unfenced, unbridled kind of passion that they're willing to put on the page. And the more mannered and sort of writing, I think, tends to be tends to date itself more readily and a little bit less relevant as the years go on.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Want flexibility? Take yoga. Want flexibility with your health insurance? Check out United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly medical, dental, and vision coverage that may be right for you. More at uh1.com.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads, generally, for most people, are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
We'll be back with Dave soon, but now it's time for my Steal of the Week. I've chosen The Audacity by Catherine Ryan. This is not a typical celebrity memoir. It's extremely funny, obviously, but it's also a fierce and moving story about the truths of contemporary womanhood. Catherine writes brilliantly. Buy this for Christmas for the best women you know, or buy it for yourself and spend Boxing Day with Catherine and a tin of Quality Street. The Audacity by Catherine Ryan is published by Blink and out now. Now, back to Dave.
I muddled through the first part of the pandemic here by reading E.B. White's letters, because there are lots of them, so it really keeps you going. And hearing about how he, you know, his right, nothing changes, quite depressingly, I think that he got paid about the same money for an article in sort of, you know, the turn of the century or, you know, sort of like pre-war era, as is like, you know, the going rate in certain publications in 2021. But his, the way he talks about the natural world and his writing and who he's writing for and his, you know, integrity and his sense of humor and how he, there's such sort of, you know, dignity in his words and in his writerly persona, but also he has a sense of humor about himself and about life, and you can see why the work remains so fresh and so vibrant.
Yeah, did you read One Man's Meat?
Oh, I think I might have read that as part of a collection. Is that him writing about the farming?
Yeah. So he leaves New York and he goes off through the country. I forget where, if he was in Maine or anyway, but he goes to live on a farm and writes about that. And it's, you know, I think that this was episodic. I think he wrote these pieces for the New Yorker from time to time. And as being sort of like an amateur gentleman farmer, but and there are a lot of them are sort of light and amusing, but suddenly in the middle of that collection, he goes back to the city and it's the late 30s and he's talking to people that are justifying or trying to apologize for Hitler. And, you know, before, during his earlier, you know, rise to power and sort of excusing the fascists, and in a way that I read this during their early, maybe the first year of Trump's presidency, and it was so familiar in a way, and he was so enraged in what had been sort of a gentle book. Suddenly, you know, he goes back to the city and gets this dose of apologism and appeasement and mealy-mouthed lack of moral clarity, and he's just spitting mad in the middle of what had been kind of a happy book about farming. And and I loved him for that. And I loved that he's willing to sort of his sense of, you know, moral direction was, I think, very true and very unshakable. And I think it comes through in the fiction, too. And I think, you know, Vonnegut had the same thing. And so many authors used to be, I'm sure it's still happening here, but maybe not as much in fiction, where that sort of moral compass comes through a little bit more nakedly sometimes. And I think that we need that, you know. I think one of the reasons I always loved Vonnegut was that he would just break out of his narrative and strip away the artifice and just tell you what was right and what was wrong and how he felt about it. And I think that that was so refreshing, and especially as a younger reader, when you're looking for that kind of clarity and you're looking for somebody to take a stand and to step off the stage and walk into the audience and tell you what he really thought. I would value more of that, I guess.
And I think with someone like Vonnegut as well, that's like his, I feel like he makes a reader feel safe in a way that enables them to step into the danger and strangeness of the book, that, you know, that ultimately the universe he's creating obeys laws that the real one should and doesn't, I suppose. And I think often of his "God damn it, babies, you've got to be kind," even though I'm very bad at remembering, you know, his plots or anything that actually happens in the books. But then, you know, sometimes I think in the hands of a different writer, that's sort of a polemic or a philosophical statement might jar. But with him, you're like, yes, of course.
Yeah, maybe he had to earn it, you know. Maybe he spent years kind of, because he had a really circuitous route through his prominence, and he struggled, you know, he wasn't a well-known writer until he was probably, I think, 46 or something. So I think by that time and what he went through in Dresden and the war, I think it gave him a certain moral ballast that it would be, that I think people recognized right away. You know, and then Vonnegut later, when his sister was killed in a car accident, and his sister's husband, he adopted their kids. And I think all of these things from his biography, I think people sort of recognized, it gave him, they saw him, or I saw him, as the real deal. So he's had a unique position to preach, I guess, from. And we could trust what he said because of what he'd seen.
On the subject of writers taking the circuitous route, are there any authors or books of sort of recent times, not necessarily recent times, that you think deserve to be much better known and much more loved?
Oh boy, yeah, there's an endless number. I mean, I'm a publisher, so we publish books at McSweeney's, our little company, all the time. That it would be great if they were sold in the hundreds of thousands of copies. There's a writer named John Brandon that we've published most of his novels, maybe all of his novels, and he has a brand new one out called Ivory Shoals. That's about right after the Civil War in the U.S. It's a young boy making his way across Florida looking for the father that he never met. And so it's a little bit, feels a little, you know, in the same era, maybe, as Huck Finn and Tom Sawyer, but there's no better contemporary writer of sentences than John Brandon. But is this a writer that you have read?
I've not read John Brandon, but now I will.
Yeah. So, yeah, why is he not read widely? Who knows? I mean, I think that there are 1,000 injustices in the book world, and they're hard to explain, because I do think all good books get published. I do believe that. But what happens at that point, I don't know. It's been this mystery that we've been living with for 25 years as publishers. And, you know, McSweeney started in 1998. We've put out, you know, maybe a couple hundred books, and so many of them would, or I think, are just as good as the books that sell are at the top of the bestseller list. And but it's very hard to figure out what, you know, gets widely read and what doesn't. But I do think he is one. All of his books are great. And he doesn't ever, can't write a bad sentence. He can't write a bad book. It's very uncanny. And I would say that a good portion of what I read is fairly obscure, I guess, because I'm often reading books by friends of mine that haven't yet had a large audience yet. I would say that there's my high school teacher named Peter Ferry, who is one of my favorite English teachers. He retired from teaching and started writing novels, and he's written a great novel called Old Heart about an octogenarian from the Midwest who abandons his adult children, lies to them, basically fakes his own death. He can go back to the Netherlands and look for the woman that he fell in love with during World War II. And it's a totally liberating and beautiful book that deserves a wider audience. But
I love so many. The premise.
He's just written a new book that he sent me the other day, and he's probably he's not slowing down at all, even though he's a little bit older than me. But I don't know. There's just so many books, and I always think about how it's a just and meritocratic world where I do think that books get published if they're well written. But once they're published, what happens after that is an utter mystery to me.
And before we go, it's all gone so quickly, I wanted to ask you what you think, other than anything you've already mentioned, what are your favorite funny books? What do you think are the funniest novels?
Well, this is going to sound unobjective, but it has to be. But my wife, Vandala Vida, wrote the book that made me laugh hardest in the last decade. It's called We Run the Tides, and it came out over there, I think, in the last 12 months. And it's about a young girl, 13, 14 years old here in San Francisco. And to me, it captured that period better than anything else I've read. And it made me laugh so hard. I, you know, periodically choked and cried and had to stop and wipe my face with my shirt. And that doesn't happen very often. I so often pick up books that the cover says it's the funniest book that somebody's ever read, and it doesn't work for me. But I think that's how humor works. It's just so incredibly subjective. But I do think I'm just very happy to be married to the funniest person I know. But I think it's also just a world that I wish that we had we had more of those books. You know, I do think even back in Vonnegut's time, you know, whenever he was being funny, people had less, you know, respect for his work. And I think that it's been very hard to publish books with a sense of humor and still get that, I guess, that respect that an author would want. And Laurie Moore is another favorite author. Really, after Dune, I was going to say that the novels that I read in college that were most personal and meant the most to me were Laurie Moore's. And she's very, very funny, but very, very serious as a novelist and as a short story writer. And those are the ones that people make me laugh out loud. But those are two people, Vandala and Laurie.
I loved Who Will Run the Frog Hospital so much because it is so funny, but so sad and serious in places. And that sense of how when you're a teenager, everything is so serious. I think she captures that with such clarity.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that was the first sort of young women coming of age book I think I read, and it's still the one that comes back to me most hauntingly. And I happens to be the book that's always on our on one of our shelves that I see every day, Face Out. So it's oddly a very ugly and unappealing cover to it. It's just like the worst cover to this book, and I hope that they've redone it by then, but it's just so off topic and off point. But but Lori Mora is just she can do no wrong in my book, and Birds of America I think is one of the very best short story in the English language. And she was the first author that I would go to the New Yorker, I would go to the magazine rack every week when I was 20 years old to see if she had a new story. So she was the first contemporary author that I was sort of keeping up with everything that she did and sort of waiting every week to see if she had written something new. And that was.
And that, you know, physically having to go to the store and look, I think, is a lost art.
Yeah. It's really hard to be funny in a novel and to sort of maintain, to not let it become, I guess, a little corny or do everything in service to a cheap laugh. But those that can do it well, like Richard Russo, I was reading an old book of his, he does it really well. Obviously, Nick Hornby does it really well. But it's a really... hard tightrope to walk, I guess.
I have so enjoyed speaking with you, Dave. Thank you so much for being on the podcast.
Thank you. It's been really fun.
Huge thanks to Dave. The Every is published by Penguin and out now. If you love The Circle, you'll be captivated by it. You can follow us at YBooked on social media. Look out for book recommendations, words of wisdom from old guests, and occasional shelfies. We love it when you share the podcast with your friends, and thank you so much to everyone who has left us a 5-star review. It helps other people to discover us and their new favourite books. You can find a list of all the books mentioned by Dave at acast.com/booked and check out his selection in our bookshop on bookshop.org. We'll be back next week. For now, I leave you with this from Barbara Trepido. It's a showy habit I've got to be always quoting poetry and stuff. Some of us use our brains and some of us use our memories. See you next time.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hey y'all, Darius Rucker here. You know, a lot of people ask me, what inspires your music? And one of the big things is a strong sense of place. That's why I love my home state of South Carolina and want to share the awesome things it has to offer. From the beautiful mountains down to the sunny coast, it's got it all. Not to mention two of my personal favorites, great golf and amazing food. Come see why I love this place. Visit discoversouthcarolina.com.